So welcome back to Cool Science Radio, everybody. I'm John Wells here, of course, with Lynn Weir Peake. Our first guests this morning are Paul Dawson and Brian Sheldon, who have written the book, Did You Just Eat That? Two scientists explore double dipping, the five-second rule, and other food myths in the lab. This is a fun book as they answer these and many other questions, but it's based on solid science as the authors will take us through all their materials and methods and help us understand good hygiene and, of course, our friends in the microbial world. Paul and Brian, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you, John.
Great to have both of you here. Now, Paul, you're a professor at Clemson University in the Food, Nutrition, and Packaging Sciences Department, and I believe that we are speaking with you from Clemson, South Carolina. Is that correct?
That is correct.
All right. And Brian, you're a professor emeritus at North Carolina State University in the departments of Food Science and Poultry Science, and we are speaking with you from West Jefferson, North Carolina.
Yes. Speaking from the mountains, about 3 hours away from Raleigh, where NC State's located.
Okay, very good. Well, you know, before we talk about your experiments and the answers to the popular questions that we all have, let's talk about our friends in the microbial world. So, Brian, let's start with you. Maybe you can tell us about this world which is not visible to the naked eye.
Well, it's an extremely vast population of organisms that we can classify as, you know, bacteria, viruses, and many other types, protozoa, et cetera. And because they're invisible, we don't tend to think that they're there. Unfortunately, some of us do get sick, and, of course, there are also a lot of positives that come from this microbial world, such as, you know, fermented foods and, of course, digestion that goes on in our gastrointestinal tracts. This population of organisms are very vast. In fact, if you, as we point out in the book, the populations far exceed that of all human beings or all cells in our own bodies. And there's probably nothing that you can see or touch that doesn't have some microorganism on it. And in that book, the first chapter is kind of like a primer on or an introduction to this mysterious world that we can't see. We talk about, you know, the vast variety and diversity and vast environmental conditions that these organisms can exist under. And we go into talking about their growth characteristics and growth requirements. And, you know, basically we've heard in the past that, you know, you can essentially isolate them from the hottest of geysers to the coldest of climates. And, of course, we also go in because of their very large population. Obviously, they're very well adapted to reproduce and under good conditions where all the nutrients are available. And, of course, we also talk a little bit about you know, some of the bad things that that these organisms can cause. In our particular case, the foodborne poisonings or intoxications that could result from eating contaminated food. So we feel it's a good introduction that if you really want to get the most out of this book, that, you know, the following chapters, that if you would take a little bit of time and read through the first chapter, that you have a better appreciation and understanding for how diverse that population is and how easily transferable it is from one surface to the other, and in the case of cross-contamination that is occurring at all times.
Yeah, and Brian, these aren't anecdotal stories. All of this is based in science, and I really enjoyed that first chapter. There were a number of takeaways from it, but one of the things that I just found that was fascinating was that although we can't see this microbial world, the average human has about 4 pounds of bacteria, yeah. each and every one of us.
We tried to make that little bit of humor, add a little humor to that first chapter in saying that perhaps that extra weight that you tried to lose can be blamed on that extra 4 pounds of bacteria that we carry. Basically, most of these organisms are carried in our GI tract as well as on our skin. And they do, as I mentioned in the book, they do, actually there's more cells, bacterial cells and other types of microorganisms in our bodies than the number of cells that we actually have on our bodies or in our bodies. So it makes up a very large and diverse population. And one can only think that there's a lot of antagonistic as well as symbiotic type of relationships that go on between these organisms in our body. A lot of it mostly for the good, but obviously sometimes there can be an imbalance when we get the wrong types of organisms, so they overpopulate in our GI tract and causes a lot of, let's just say, distress and discomfort.
Yes. Now, Paul, you don't know my mom, but you ought to because you'd have a really good time with her. Her famous saying is, "I've never poisoned anyone." And she uses this excuse after she's mistakenly left out the chicken casserole all night and discovers it in the morning and then puts it in the refrigerator. And then she declares she's never poisoned anyone. Is that how's she doing on myth there?
Well, I guess that might categorize that under luck or playing Russian roulette, so to speak, with the food poisoning. Yeah, that's one of the things, that's one of the basic premises, and I think we covered that like in the last, kind of summing up the book in the last chapter. Common sense things where you keep food either hot or cold.
Yeah.
Don't leave it at room temperature. Don't leave it warm. And that certainly is taking a risk for sure. So I'm glad nobody's gotten sick, but that's taking a chance there.
I think I'll pass this book on to her. And, you know, you two have had so much fun writing this book, which it's bringing what you're doing in the lab, that's pretty serious work, out to the public in a really palatable way. Palatable is kind of a funny word to use, but in a fun way. And so I'm wondering things like, it's funny, there are many things that we won't do. We won't maybe, you know, take a sip off someone else's beverage in an aluminum can. But boy, that 5-second rule, we'll do just about anything, say, declaring the 5-second rule, when if we really thought about it, we'd know that you get the same bacteria in 2 seconds as you would if you sort of left it there 20 seconds. Or am I mistaken?
Well, yeah, you're from a practical standpoint, you're correct. There's some the statistical data and the actual, I think, real-life data, sometimes, and that's some of the interpretation we need to do comes into play. We actually found, and there's one other paper published on this topic, that specifically on this topic, where if you do leave it there longer, you may find a higher number of bacteria, but the number of bacteria picked up immediately is so high enough that essentially you're getting bacteria 1 second, 2 seconds, or whatever, it's how quickly you can pick it up. So it's an immediate transfer, so to speak. And it also depends on other factors, surface properties, moisture content. But essentially, yeah, you're picking up the bacteria that's on that surface, whether it be a floor or a counter or whatever. I guess, and then people can say they don't get sick their whole life from eating food off the floor. Well, it depends on what's on the floor. You know, that's really what the point is. And our specific experiment was to see if it was transferred in 5 seconds, not to see if you randomly went around a university or your house or whatever and picked up food off the floor and ate it, whether you get sick or not, because that, again, depends on what's on the floor.
Yeah.
So maybe that's kind of going back to your mother, that maybe she's somehow got a good sanitary kitchen or the area is very sanitary, so there's not any contamination getting in there, but it's very difficult to really prevent that in any setting.
Exactly. If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Paul Dawson, a professor at Clemson University, and we're speaking with him from Clemson, South Carolina, and Brian Sheldon, who is professor emeritus from North Carolina State University. We're speaking with him from West Jefferson, North Carolina. They have written the book, Did You Just Eat That? Two Scientists Explore Double Dipping, the 5-Second Rule, and Other Food Myths in the Lab. Why don't we talk about a couple of these, hand dryers or bacterial blowers. And gentlemen, either of you, please chime in.
Well, I guess this is Paul, I'll maybe go first. Yeah, what was the fun part, I think it was mentioned before, is some of the trivia and background into some of the topics we covered, and this is one kind of delved into, and it's interesting that we looked into it that you know, in hospital medical settings, blower hand dryers are not used, they're not allowed, not supposed to be used there, and the reason being exactly what the second part of that title is, they do, as you might guess, blow bacteria around, and so there's, we got to look at other studies as well, and we did a research ourselves. That one example was, I think one researcher put black paint on the hands of a subject, and at the same time they were wearing a white Tibet suit, and then he stuck their hands in front of the hand dryer and kind of observed where the black paint went, and there's spots all over the front of the Tibet suit from the face down to the chest area, showing an example. Of course, that's not exactly like bacteria, but water droplets carry bacteria. So an example of where any surfaces and any fluids are going around the area. And there's other studies where they're actually measuring bacteria, and we did the same thing where they're blowing 3 to 6 feet away from the blower. So clearly, anytime you're blowing air, whether you're talking or blowing, and I guess the parallel that would be blowing birthday candles out, and we'll get to that later, but you're blowing bacteria because they can ride on water droplets, which are, I think we looked at, did some research and found they were up to 10 times the size of a bacteria. So there's plenty of bacteria can ride on one water droplet, and you're generating those. So, yeah, I think about it now when I go to in a bathroom and has a blower, because when you put your hand in front of it, a lot of times you feel air going up into your face and nose area. So, you know, whatever's there is being kind of circulated around. And I guess we got the idea because it used to be, I don't see it much anymore, but it used to be on hand dryers when I was growing up, where it said one thing there, more sanitary than paper towels or towels. And I always wondered about that because, again, it's blowing air around. And I really think that's not necessarily true because, again, in a medical setting, they're not used.
If I could add a couple more little things that we do discuss in the book, and it's relative to the dryers, is that the new dryers these days, I'm sure you both have seen them and have used them, these very high velocity, 300 miles per hour type thing. Sounds like the jet engine going off. And you can imagine, compared to the older models there that have much lower velocity as far as air movement, how much more you could blow those organisms all over the room. And another maybe not a good thing to think about is there's been enough studies done to show that even flushing the toilet generates these bioaerosols that obviously can contain fecal bacteria. Uh-huh. You imagine that's, you have flushing going on in these restrooms along with the hand dryers blowing. You can see where you could actually cross-contaminate, many of the people who are in that, using that facility.
Yeah, correct me if I'm wrong. In a ladies' room, they have separate stalls so that blowback from the spray, when they flush the toilet, may be contained to that stall, versus in the men's room where you have urinals side by side, very easily, if someone flushes next to you while you're still using the urinal, you could get a spray that blows back in that situation versus the ladies' room. Is that correct?
I think it's somewhat more contained. Of course, these aerosols are they travel very light, and they would eventually go up. But, yeah, there'd be some containment there, I would guess.
It also probably depends upon the air movement in the restroom itself. If there's vents and, ventilation that's going on, and there's some sort of inlet as well as outlet. Most bathrooms probably have some way of venting the moisture. And so I would think that, and there's been studies shown that even in our home bathrooms, that you have your toothbrush across the room on the, on the countertop, and you flush the toilet, they found fecal matter on the toothbrushes. So it just shows you that it can go for, multiple feet from the toilet.
And it was fun. We actually, when the study, we went out into the public. Like we talk about it. It's two phases we do in the lab, but also we do surveys out in the public or domain. And we went out to various sites around the university or town and sampled blow dryers in grocery stores and gas stations and even ones on campus. And we swabbed the other thing is button. You swab the push button because you're pushing buttons. And also the intake vent below is sucking in air, as Brian mentioned, from the bathroom over and over again. So you can imagine that's being concentrated on the intake. So we thought that, you know, eventually there's going to be a buildup there, and every time you turn the dryer on, you could be recirculating that. And the button brings me to mind. I was been traveling, you know, recently, flying, and this may be a whole other study, but I saw in some of the airports they have these. You know, you go to the laboratory and you walk out, and they have these push button as you go out the laboratory to say the cleanliness of the laboratory is like yes, no, kind of. I'm thinking. There's a certain percent of people who don't wash their hands when they go to the laboratory. And so they're going out and pushing these buttons, and I don't believe I'm going to go behind them. And I've never pushed one of those buttons. So those kind of things are also things to consider.
I just want to restate one of the points that you made earlier, and that is that a bacteria just doesn't flow out of the toilets or out of your mouth when you're speaking or coughing. It needs to be on some sort of water droplet to be able to do that. Is that correct?
Well, water droplet or dust particle, either one, yeah.
Okay, well, I think I'll never go into a public restroom again. But that leads me to the next question. Well, first of all, I was thinking that, you know, I know studies have been done on this where a lot of people, if there's no one else in the bathroom, they don't even wash their hands, they just leave. But if people are there witnessing them in the bathroom, in the public bathroom, then they will go and wash their hands, which is an interesting human nature sort of story. But so the idea is, if you're going to wash your hands, you must really use a lot of soap and really wash them versus what some of us do when we're in a hurry is just, you know, run a few cups of water over our fingertips and then go to the dryer, because really that's when there's going to be that concentration of bacteria. Is that correct?
Well, yeah,
that's true.
That's true. I mean, actually, well, that was a book. I read that chapter where we did compare a complete hand washing versus just rinsing with warm water or rinsing with cold water. And, yeah, found almost a stepwise increase in the number of bacteria left from soap, a good washing up to just rinsing. So, yeah, you're exactly right. Just rinse it off and stick it in a hand dryer. You're going to magnify or multiply the number of bacteria flying around the room off your hands.
Right. Well, maybe we can leave the bathroom and all this potty talk for a while. let's go into the kitchen because, well, that's no less dire, really. I remember years ago seeing a study that was done on, it might have been something like Good Morning America or a show like that where they used some sort, you know, like the black light, and then they had someone cooking with chicken who was washing their hands in between everything that they did with the chicken. And yet you turn off the lights and, you know, the bacteria lights up under this black light and it's all over the kitchen. So, you know, most of us don't necessarily wash our hands meticulously when we're cooking, and sometimes we do, and yet we seem to somehow survive. I guess this is going back to my mom. But, you know, could you talk about how much it's spread throughout the kitchen, and what does that really mean for our health?
Well, I'll start there and let Paul chime in. And basically, in reading this book, obviously we don't want to have everybody fear what they're doing. And I guess that always look at the bottom line is that I eat three meals a day, 365 days a year, and I'm not getting sick every day. A lot of this depends upon, again, you can relate it to your question about the kitchen. It is related to what the organisms are. I mean, if they're not pathogenic to us, they're not going to cause us any harm. So, there has to be pathogens that can get us sick, available, and they have to be out of a certain population. And depending upon that population, if we are healthy, a healthy human adult has to get a much higher dose of the organism in order to get sick, as opposed to somebody, you know, very old or very young. Mm-hmm. And then another question comes down to how much of the food are you consuming? I may have three helpings, you only have one, so my dosage is going to be much larger, and there's a greater probability or risk that I could come down with some illness. And then I think one of the more important things is that our innate immunity. and that, you know, if we are healthy, our immune system is going to be healthy, and we're more able to fight it off, and it would require much higher population of organisms to get sick, as opposed to somebody who's, let's just say, had a heart transplant and is on anti-rejection medicine. That person is always going to be compromised and has to take, can't afford the risk.
Right.
And we just received a text from a listener that wanted to know about double dipping. We have a couple of questions that have come in from texts or from phone calls. So if you could just give us sort of the summary of double dipping, and I'll ask you the next question.
Yeah, I'll start with that one. Double dipping, we did three different experiments, but essentially the gist of it was we got down to finding, we initially thought there wouldn't be much transfer because you think you bite a cracker and there's not much surface area there, just dip it in the dip. When we found there was, we ended up testing salsa, chocolate, and cheese dip. I think there are three common dips that are used. And oddly enough, or nicely enough, they all have pretty much different pH levels, which you think of pH, the lower the pH, the more inhibition you'd have for bacteria. And salsa is about 4, chocolate's about 5, and cheese is about 6 pH. So that was kind of nice linear spread there for us. But we found that there was a significant transfer of bacteria from the mouth to the dip, even though it was just that surface area we talked about. Interesting enough, salsa had a much higher, much greater transfer than the other two dips. And while we were kind of at first using water instead of real dips, this kind of was an obvious thing, but we didn't really see it coming, that salsa is actually thinner. So when you dip a chip in there, or cracker or carrot or whatever you're dipping, then more of the, quote, contaminated dip's going to fall back in to the dip, common dip bowl. So
right.
Salsa is getting a greater amount of bacteria, or a thinner dip would be. But there's still transfer in all three dips. Of course, we left it there 2 hours trying to simulate a party. Obviously, like a Super Bowl party or a holiday gathering might be even longer than 2 hours. We wanted to see what happened over a period of time at room temperature. And, again, as you might expect, there was a reduction in the number of bacteria in the salsa because of the lower pH, whereas the cheese and the chocolate kind of leveled off. There wasn't much change. So I guess that, as we talked about before, that's a transfer of oral bacteria, as we mentioned before. So that risk is more of a common cold virus or whatever bacterial infection versus the common foodborne pathogens we talk about. But there's definitely a transfer of the oral bacteria to a dip bowl. So I guess you want to watch that, who you're sharing the dip with.
Right. So the book.
Yeah, we found that essentially every time you dipped it in, and once it reaches your mouth, you know, it picks up, like Paul said, everything that's in your mouth. And every time it went back into that bowl, be it, you know, salsa or whatever, it transferred, you know, approximately 2,000 organisms. And you can imagine how many, and of course I've seen people not only single dip, but then double dip and triple dip with the same, you know, with the same chip or cracker. And
they're not
going
to get invited back to the party, are they?
At night, you can really develop a fairly significant population of organisms.
Right. Gentlemen, we're almost out of time. Actually, we are out of time, but I did want to slip in one more question if you could give a 30-second answer. We just received a call from a listener that just wanted to know, in general, how to prevent from getting sick. And it's if one of you could tackle this for just 30 seconds or so, because we are out of time.
You can take that,
Brian, you want to go take that first?
If you read the book, throughout there, we really emphasize washing your hands and using, you know, a recommended procedure. The National Restaurant Association has what's called the ServSafe procedure. It's a warm rinse followed, you know, like 10 seconds of that, 10 seconds of this lathering up with soap, and then 10 seconds of a warm rinse. That, and, you know, in our last chapter, we talk about keeping hot food hot, cold food cold, proper storage conditions, proper heating temperatures achieved, using, you know, a meat thermometer and that sort of thing. Don't cross-contaminate between, say, a cutting board used in cutting up chicken versus the finished product. Use separate cutting board, or at least wash it thoroughly with soap, and even maybe take it through a cycle in the dishwasher. And then, I guess last, just consider the type of what you engage in. You know, like parent playing the beer pong game, that ping pong ball falls all over the floor, on the dirt, grass, wherever you're playing it, can acquire a lot of different organisms. There's a risk in everything, and even though it might be remote that you're going to get sick, again, you increase your risk of something happening when you engage in maybe questionable practices.
Paul Dawson, Brian Sheldon, they wrote the book, Did You Just Eat That? Two Scientists Explore Double Dipping, The 5-Second Rule, and a whole bunch of other myths in the laboratory. Gentlemen, thank you for writing this book, and thanks for being with us on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you.
Thank you, John, Lynn. Right. Appreciate it.
Okay.